RunAsRadio.com. You're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 202 with guest Steve Riley, recorded Thursday, February 3rd, 2011. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow the boys on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell. You're listening to Run As Radio. With me, my co-host, Greg Hughes.
And yes, I am with you as your co-host.
Yes.
How are you?
I'm well, sir. We're plunking right along. And I don't know, Steve, how many times have you been on the show now? Four, five?
You know, I was looking through the archive the other day, and I think we're approaching about four or five, yeah, something like that.
Well, and I mean, back in the Microsoft Steve days, we saw each other half a dozen times a year at various odd countries.
Yeah, it seemed to be that same series of countries and the same weeks of each month, too. It was like, well, you know, weren't we here this exact week last year?
Yeah. But, you know, things have changed. I remember the year where everyone wore a T-shirt that said, "Where's Steve?"
You know, that felt, that was kind of a really humbling experience.
Yeah.
I really had no idea of just how much impact I had on other people's work through what I was doing at Microsoft until I left there and I saw all those T-shirts and the comments and notes that I got from people were just, they were wonderful. I've still kept many of them to this day.
That's great. Well, I certainly felt that way. It was a shocker to me. I'm going to only read the first sentence of the new bio because I think it says everything we really need to know. Steve Riley is the technical leader in the office of the CTO at Riverbed Technology, an innovator in wide area networking and storage optimization. Steve, Riverbed.
Riverbed.
Yeah. No, and I got nothing for respect for Riverbed. I mean, I think their original product, which was what, Steelhead?
Steelhead, yes. And it is still the primary product. Yes.
And it was all about making Exchange go faster in remote offices, right? In your branch office.
Well, that was kind of the original vision of the founders of the company, was that, WAN links, private WAN links are expensive, and there's no sign that they're going to go down. And the traffic that people are putting over it has a lot of characteristics that lend itself well to optimization and compression. Mm-hmm. So if a customer can choose to use just some sort of plain old high-speed internet connection, maybe, you know, at a branch office, you get a cable connection, right?
Right.
Professional-grade Comcast or something like that. Put a Steelhead appliance there and get traffic reduction anywhere between 30% and 90% in the amount of data that's going over the wire, you can significantly reduce the cost. So, you know, I really enjoyed my time at Amazon Web Services, but I reached a point where, and this is going to sound really bad, but you just get tired of fighting the bad guys all the time.
Yeah.
And I was feeling the calling to get back to sort of the WAN and telco roots where my career began when I worked at an electric company in Ohio. Yeah. And Riverbed, a recruiter, contacted me about an opportunity in the office of the CTO that was cloud and virtualization related, looking for someone to do a bit of competitive analysis and research, be a technical resource to product and marketing teams, represent Riverbed at customers and industry consortia, kind of fit right along with the experience I gained at Amazon Web Services, plus at the same time allowed me to return to what I really love, which is building networks, and went out for the interview. It was fantastic, wonderful people. Small organization with a great vision and really fast and capable execution. And so, you know, here I am.
What? Yeah. Can't argue with that, man. That's good stuff.
And congratulations on the move.
Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
So tell for those who don't know Riverbed, I've just sort of given you the one sentence version. You've, you know, elaborated on that a bit more. What do they really do? What's their thing?
The intention is not to try to be a Cisco or a Juniper or Extreme Networks clone. You know, those guys are really good at that core networking. What we're doing at Riverbed is carving out a niche to try to address challenging, intractable problems that people seem to be having. And, of course, the big one is wide area network optimization. And that's where we spend the bulk of our time is on that. But we try to cover all the platforms. So there's steelhead appliances of various sizes that people can put in data centers or branch offices. There's a cloud steelhead, which is a virtual appliance. As a matter of fact, it runs on an Amazon EC2 instance. And then we have steelhead mobile, which runs on the laptop. When I look at the steelhead mobile client on my laptop, I'm seeing a very decent amount of traffic reduction between it and the CorpNet back in San Francisco. So we try to address any place where somebody might be able to put a pair of steelheads, whether it's appliance to appliance or appliance to cloud or mobile to cloud. Any opportunity we get to compress the traffic means that the customer can save money on their telco bills. I've got kind of this vision that the new age organization where they don't have a central IT department anymore. And I know that for many people who will be listening to this broadcast later, that the mere mention of that is going to make your sphincter clench so tight diamonds are going to be coming out of your ass. But it doesn't mean your job is going to go away. No. It just means you might think differently because all that central IT is now in the cloud.
Right.
And I have nothing but praise for the technology at Amazon Web Services. You know, I saw a lot of it firsthand. It's absolutely fantastic technology. You can put it all there, put cloud steelhead in front of everything, and then deploy an appliance in your branch offices or a mobile on all of your road warriors, and it's amazing what you might be able to accomplish. But that's not just the only thing that Riverbed is making itself known for. Organizations have tremendous amounts of data. I saw a report from 2009 that the IDC group did, and it stated that humans are generating an exabyte of data a day. Now, you can go out to Wikipedia and find out how many zeros are in an exabyte. It's bigger than you think.
It's a million terabytes.
Yes, exactly. And that's per day. Yeah. Now, where is all that stuff going? It's going to the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
So another one of our stellar products is an appliance called Whitewater, which optimizes and deduplicates data in your data center before you store it in the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
So this acts as a gateway between your backup software and your Amazon S3 bucket. Instead of you having to find some tool or write your own utility that talks to the Amazon S3 APIs, you drop a Whitewater appliance into your data center. You point backup exec or whatever software you use to the Whitewater, and it knows how to talk SIFS and NFS. So, you know, it's on the customer side, it uses whatever protocol you're used to. You don't have to change anything other than that destination server name, right?
Mm-hmm.
The appliance translates the data into Amazon S3 APIs, compresses, deduplicates, ships up to your bucket. It's also encrypted in transit and at rest. So neither Riverbed nor Amazon has your key. Only you do. This helps you satisfy a lot of regulatory requirements. So, you know, even HIPAA data could be stored there because it's encrypted. That satisfies the requirement for that. Now, let's imagine a scenario where you need to do disaster recovery. And let's say that it's a really bad scenario, that your site got wiped out, including your Riverbed Whitewater appliance.
Right.
Not only that, let's say that Amazon lost two availability zones in a region.
Wow.
Well, the beauty of Amazon S3 is that it can survive the loss of two availability zones and your data is still intact in another availability zone.
Mm-hmm.
So you could bring up a virtual Whitewater on some 386 PC you drag out of your house's basement, connect that to your Amazon S3 bucket, and you could reconstitute your data center. It's going to take a little time, but you could at least do it. So the idea is, you know, thinking from the worst case scenario and then designing backwards so that you can still keep yourself in business.
is this a backup mechanism that we're talking about, or are you, or would the, could this also be used as sort of your live storage to leverage Amazon for live storage for your application?
We principally position it as backup, not as primary storage. It certainly doesn't mean you couldn't use it as primary storage. However, a lot of applications still have latency sensitivity issues. Right, and there's not much that we can do to address the latency issues between your data center and Amazon S3. If you are in Virginia or Seattle or Northern California, maybe you won't have a problem. If you're in the middle of Iowa, you know, you've got backhaul latency that Whitewater won't address.
Yeah, okay.
You don't sound so security-centric these days, Steve.
I have not lost my love for that which helped me solve so many people's problems. Mm-hmm. So I am still very concerned about continuing to do what I can to make the internet a safe place to live, work, play, shop, and love. Mm-hmm. But there, like I said, totally concentrating on that all of the time, I just got a bit weary, and I wanted to get back to just building stuff. And if that sounds defeatist, perhaps it does. But, you know, I'm 45 in a couple of days, and aren't you supposed to be doing major changes at 45? Some people buy red sports cars. I leave the large corporate world and InfoSec and go to a nice small company that has successfully carved out a leadership position in a niche product, and I'm working for some incredibly bright and fun people. And
cool.
It's like it's not even work now. Having said that, I don't intend to disappear from the security community at all. And in some respects, I think that some of the work that I do at Riverbed can apply to solve security problems, particularly around storage in the cloud, for example.
Sure.
A Whitewater appliance eliminates the concerns that people have about storing data in a public cloud provider. And in many ways, we're looking to see how we can do kind of the same things with Steelhead. How can we address some of the security concerns people might have as they transition from on-premise to shared infrastructure?
So what do you think of what Microsoft's been doing with Azure so far?
Well, you know, I haven't really followed it very closely. And this is partly at Amazon. I was so focused on Amazon's technology and ensuring that I was able to help customers understand and implement it appropriately that I actually didn't follow Azure a whole lot. In my new role as kind of the cloud guy at Riverbed, I expect to get a lot more familiar with what many of the cloud people are, cloud providers are doing. So, you know, not just Amazon, not just Azure, but also, you know, I don't think we can discount the telcos. The telcos made some mistakes at the beginning, especially, you know, a decade or so ago in the ASP craze. And it wasn't just them. I mean, I remember doing a consulting project for a trash company that tried to spawn off an ASP subdivision that is, you know, long since history. You know, the Verizons and AT&Ts, they're going to become not insignificant cloud players, then they're going to win a lot of the market because they've already got a certain amount of enterprise trust that some of the other cloud names don't have. So I see the challenge that both Amazon Web Services and Azure has is up-leveling their enterprise visibility and how they communicate to the enterprise. And it largely has to do with winning trust about security.
Sure.
You know, I worked really, really hard in my 18 months at Amazon to try to demonstrate to customers how Amazon secures its cloud and how in many instances a cloud provider can be more secure than something that you do in-house. There is a lot of FUD that has to be fought. There are people who are writing magazine articles that that basically say the cloud can never be secure, and they write the article because they know it'll sell. So, you know, they're trying to get themselves paid, of course. There are a lot of IT folks who, just to kind of be a little blunt, view the cloud as the end of their career.
Yeah.
And boys and girls, let me tell you, this is an opportunity for you to learn something completely new. You know, we don't have a buggy whip industry anymore. The smart buggy whip manufacturers learned how to build automobile starters.
Yep.
So the smart rackers and stackers are going to have to start to learn a little bit of code. Your infrastructure will now be code, and you will be writing scripts to start and stop virtual machines, to configure virtualized infrastructure in regions that are far flung from where you happen to be. But it doesn't matter, right? I've got a 50 megabit per second connection in my house.
Right.
I don't need to go anyplace. I can do everything I need from the laptop and my couch. It's going to be the same for sysadmins of the future. You're going to be sitting in a console, you're going to be writing scripts, and you're going to be starting and stopping infrastructure in places where, you know, you physically can't get yourself to, but it doesn't matter because it's all just up in the cloud. And the security concerns are never going to go away, and I hope to continue to be able to help people understand how to adapt to this new model, how to change their thinking, and how to change their processes.
There's always going to be work in that area.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I've been really impressed with what Rackspace has done in sort of becoming a cloud player too.
They have an amazing execution. And what's kind of interesting is, you know, everybody looks at AWS as the model. And they are. They invented
the space.
Utility computing.
And I would also give them credit for this. And they did it for the right reason. They did it because they needed it. They didn't make it as a product. They made it as an infrastructure they were using and said, hey, let's sell some on the side.
Kind of that way, yeah. Although there's a common misconception that AWS was excess capacity on Amazon.com. And that's
right.
Actually not true.
Okay.
You know, Amazon, first and foremost, is a technology company. Just their first product they sold through the technology was books, right? But now you can buy just about everything.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, you know, we've done this so well, I think we can sell parts of ourselves. So let's take what we learned in building the retail site and build up a utility computing site and sell ourselves, basically. I know that in everywhere outside of the county in which Las Vegas is in, selling yourself is illegal. But anyway, so it was built from the ground up to do what it does. And, you know, they invented utility computing, and it was only later that this thing could become called cloud computing.
Right.
However, the people who are watching them very closely have identified a few things that they think they can do better. And, you know, Rackspace is probably one of those organizations that has looked at what Amazon did really, really well, looked at what they could have done better, and iterated on that. And it's kind of interesting. There's a guy, I think his name is Guy Rosen. He has a website called Jack of All Clouds.
Great name.
Yeah, jackofallclouds.com by Guy Rosen. He's researching what the cloud providers are being used for. Mm-hmm. So about every month or so, he has a post called State of the Cloud. And he's measuring instance starts. You know, it's kind of a rough measurement. A lot of instances that get started on these cloud providers last less than, you know, a day or even an hour in some cases. But if you look at what's in his charts, it's Amazon EC2 and Rackspace Cloud Servers. These are the only two people who are significant players. All
right.
Of the other guys are barely mentioned.
Right.
What is Rackspace doing that continues to draw a lot of business? One of them has to do with the SLA. They simply have a better SLA. The language is simpler. They guarantee 100% uptime. That's going to draw a certain class of customer who just wants to see a strong, fanatical commitment to support. It's easier to reach a human at Rackspace than it is at Amazon EC2. Amazon provides itself on self-service. That's how they can offer the services so inexpensively.
Sure.
And if you're really, really smart, you know, that will probably be the way to go. If you need someone who holds your hand a little bit more, Rackspace would be the place to go. So the market is wide open. There's all kinds of room for everybody. And I'm going to really enjoy now just kind of being an observer in this and helping customers choose whatever is appropriate for their business problem and then providing suggestions and ideas for how to optimize and accelerate what they put in place.
All right, so here's a question for you, Steve. So for the average IT person out there working who right now is not involved in the cloud, who wants to become more forward-thinking, what's Steve's top three list of things that they need to know or do?
Okay. It's kind of interesting that you asked that because I have a presentation called Everything You Think You Know in the Cloud is Wrong.
All right.
And I cover three specific areas. One is about application architecture. A certain class of applications can forklift into the cloud with almost no modifications. These would be applications that are already designed to be run on web servers and are fairly stateless. Also, curiously enough, applications that have a lot of application-level self-monitoring and healing are good for forklifting into the cloud. Exchange 2010 and SharePoint 2010 moved to the cloud incredibly well. Amazon IT is in the process of moving Exchange and SharePoint, you know, internal Exchange and SharePoint, from on-premise into AWS. So that's an amazing project to watch. Other applications, monolithic, bulky things, they're not going to work very well in the cloud. So in some cases, customers are going to need to re-architect to take advantage of the scalability, the redundancy. You want to make sure you're using queuing and messaging services so you don't build in dependencies, these kinds of things. So learning how to architect for the cloud is step number one. Step number two is learning how to secure for the cloud. And it's all about changing the definition of control. If you used to define your control based on possession and location, you're going to have to change that now. And instead, you define your control by relying on encryption, digital signatures, service level agreements, and security standards. The world has already done this for pipe. Nobody owns the internet, right? Very few people deploy their own WAN links. We just buy connectivity from the telcos and we use SSL on top of it. You can apply the same thinking to compute and storage as well. I believe you don't have to own the infrastructure. You can let somebody else manage it, but you can still own and control the data. So you need to talk to your cloud provider and say, okay, provider, if I'm storing my data in your location, the most important question is who owns the data? And if the provider does not explicitly say, you customer remain the owner of your data, move to another provider. And that's one thing that I've got to give Amazon credit for. They're very, very clear about ownership of data, is that it still belongs to the customer, not to Amazon Web Services.
Right,
then the
right.
Third thing is something that I alluded to earlier, is the way we administer systems is going to change. Infrastructure becomes code. Scripting becomes important. Companies like OpSource and what they're doing with chef agents are going to become more and more critical over time. So these are the three fundamental changes that an IT shop is going to have to make to take advantage of the cloud. And then, of course, once you do all of that and you find that your network utilization is going to go way up because things aren't in-house anymore, that's where companies like Riverbed can help you cut those telco bills by putting optimization and data deduplication products in strategic spots around the world.
Well, and it's interesting, here in Canada, we recently had a big crisis in the internet in the sense that they were trying to pass a law to make usage measurement a requirement, that we were going to see much more clamping down on the number of gigabytes a given connection got to use. It was actually going to be law. our equivalent of the FCC, the CRTC, was looking at this. It's now, they're now backing off on it. But I've also seen, you know, the 3G guys, the AT&Ts of the world, saying no more all-you-can-eat data plans. Like, in general, there seems to be some pressure on limiting bandwidth.
Yeah. You know, I mentioned earlier about that IDC report and, you know, the exabyte of data a day, and it's all going to the cloud.
Yeah.
One of the natural questions that comes out is, where the hell is it all coming from?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you guys noticed, but did you catch that according to two of the four or five organizations that track IPv4 addresses that yesterday was the last day?
Yeah, we're out, right?
We're out. Yeah. Actually, there are five /8s that are left, and what I guess is going to happen is the IANA will be contractually bound to release one of those to each of the five RIRs.
Right.
But basically, we're out, right? And if you think about it, in my own house, I know that five public IP addresses are being used.
Yeah.
One for my phone, my wife's phone, each of my kids' phones, so there's four, and then one on my cable modem router, right?
Right.
So to answer the question, where is that exabyte of data a day coming from? It's coming from the world. The amount of people creating content has exploded as developing countries skipped the wireline generation and went directly to wireless. So this explosion of mobile devices creating content, pushing it to online storage, is just it's causing the networks to break. They're just absolutely crumbling because they weren't built to handle the amount of traffic that's being put on them right now. And so this is kind of the business problem that Riverbed identified at its founding that it wanted to get really, really good at solving. And we now command 60% of the market is solving this particular problem. And it's never going to go away.
No.
It's
a constant issue. I just wonder how we're ultimately going to get better at dealing with this. And, you know, an awful lot of this infrastructure we're counting on was built on the back of bankrupt companies coming out of the dot-com boom.
Oh, yeah. WorldCom, Enron. Yeah.
All these guys have laid down an awful lot of fiber that, you know, like the whole Indian outsourcing thing wouldn't have happened if those guys hadn't pulled all that fiber and then went broke.
Yeah. Well, the amount of dark fiber that is in the streets is actually kind of amazing. I remember when I was working at Microsoft, in Microsoft Consulting, one of the first projects was at Quest. So I spent about 14 months off and on in their offices in Denver. And talking to some of the fiber guys, and you know, of course, now we're now looking at what maybe 11 years ago, but the amount of fiber in the ground that was lit was a small percentage of the total amount of fiber in the ground. So in some cases, I think they might have planned ahead appropriately, at least in large metropolitan areas. Perhaps a lot of that fiber is lit now. I don't really know. But the last mile problem is where it still continues to be an issue.
Sure.
For example,
yeah.
A lot of it has to do with city government regulations just being turgid in getting to the 21st century. I live in Seattle, which is on the west side of Lake Washington. I have one choice for high-speed bandwidth, and that's Comcast. People who live in Redmond on the east side of Lake Washington, they've got two choices. They can choose Comcast or they can go with Fios from Verizon. My bill for 50 megabits per second is higher than if I were in Redmond. Even if I were still using Comcast, it would be lower because there's competition over there. There's
right.
No competition in Seattle. Why did Verizon not put Fios over on the west side of Lake Washington, which arguably has probably a higher population and more people who would use it? I can't answer that. Maybe there's some contract with the city of Seattle that prevented them from doing it. I'm beginning to think that the blame lies more and more with non-responsive government agencies. And it's, you know, being the political liberal that I am, I'm kind of shocked these words are coming out of my mouth. than with, telcos dragging their feet, although there's plenty of that too.
Yeah, nobody's intended to do anything about it. My frustration with government here is not that we don't have sufficient regulation, it's that there's just no enforcement.
Yeah.
We're not actually following the rules we put out.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess since this is a public broadcast, I better just keep my opinions on the way the whole WikiLeaks thing was handled to myself, because it could get me in trouble, and I might get pulled over at an airport.
I loved your blog post with Julian Assange and Mark Rosenberg. It's just a beautiful contrast. They both do the same things. They're giving away information for free.
But
very funny. Yeah. One's being pursued by the police, and the other one is Time's Man of the Year. Yeah, brilliant stuff, Bob. And just an interesting state of affairs for all of us, actually.
Yeah, I did buy an ebook version of the New York Times new publication about that, mm-hmm. that kind of chronicles the saga. I haven't read it yet, but I'm looking forward to that. It should be interesting.
It's also interesting to see the consequence, of the shutting down of the internet in Egypt. I almost get a sense that we're not that far away from a UN statement that includes internet access alongside essential services for life.
Didn't Norway already do that?
But that's the Norwegians. I'm thinking more on a...
You're dismissing it as if that's something unusual, but yet you just asked for what the Norwegian government granted its citizens.
Yeah,
that connectivity is a right, not a privilege.
Right, and I think it's.
I find myself in agreement with that.
Well, I'm teasing, but the idea of thinking it at a UN level that because look at the change that it creates when we have when people have the opportunity to communicate at this level, that shouldn't one of the millennium goals that the UN puts out be, getting connectivity to everyone.
We hold these truths to be self-evident. Yep.
Yeah, and how do we ensure that they are truths? By providing mechanisms for disseminating, discussing them, and vetting them, right? Crank can put up whatever they want. Case in point, Jenny McCarthy and all of her vaccine anti-denialism. Yeah. And unfortunately, the internet allows cranks to amplify their crankiness.
Yeah.
But what ultimately happens is by continuing to shine the harsh reality of science on something like that, we learn over time that she's just full of crap, and that the reason why we're seeing a rise in these preventable diseases is precisely because people are not, following basic science. So I think while the internet was the mechanism that she was able to get her crankiness out, it's also the mechanism by which she's now finally being discredited.
Yeah. And not in some ways, the internet does not allow falsehoods to survive. It takes time, but ultimately the truth does come out, and in a much more coherent fashion. You can't survive on rumor on the internet. It doesn't live.
You get a lot more rumor a lot faster with the internet, but it also has its sort of its clean itself up mechanism. So the signal to noise ratio can be quite high, but there's a lot of great information mixed in there somewhere.
I've said for a long time that the beauty of the internet is that not only does it route around outages, but it routes around censorship as well.
Now all we got to do is get a better stupidity router, and we'd really have it made.
Yeah. And when my son was in fourth grade, his teacher at the beginning of the year specifically prohibited using Wikipedia as a source for research because Wikipedia is not assembled by a credentialed body.
Yep, that's true.
And while I was not really successful in changing the mind of this particular teacher, it did give me the chance to discuss with my own children and then talk with other people that while, yes, at any point in time, you could point to a particular page in Wikipedia and say, that's a bunch of crap, come back a day later and somebody with a vested interest in truth will have fixed it.
Mm-hmm.
Every once in a while, I love to just cruise through the most active Wikipedia talk pages and look at the discussion that's going on. It's amazingly self-corrective. And in the aggregate, I believe it's probably one of the most reliable sources of information that humans have ever assembled.
Well, you also can see an interesting level of functional diplomacy. Go after hotbed topics. Go look at topics around Palestine and Israel and look at how both sides have come to language they agree on for the most part.
Yes. Well, here's one for you. A bit pedantic in comparison to the point you just brought up. But I remember one time, I just kind of curious, I went to Encarta and did a search on the word Wikipedia. And it dropped me to the generalized entry labeled encyclopedia. And there was a single sentence about Wikipedia, an online encyclopedia assembled by unknown persons. Then I went to Wikipedia and looked up Encarta and got an enormous article on the entire history of how Funk and Wagnalls sold their content to Microsoft. The comparison was astounding.
It speaks volumes.
Encarta tries to downplay Wikipedia and say it's not authoritative. Wikipedia demonstrates through its own recorded history of Encarta its own superior authoritativeness.
It's brilliant.
Well, and just as a touch point and a measure here, if you go to Wikipedia and search for Steve Riley, that one of the options is Steve Riley, Amazon Web Services Evangelist. There's no article there, but there's a stub. So it's a little out of date, but at least it doesn't say Microsoft.
Right. There's a stub, no article.
Yeah.
Gee, yeah.
Exactly.
I wonder who I could get to fix that for me.
Well, at least it says Amazon instead of Microsoft.
Yes, but we'll have to get that updated somehow.
Okay. Well, you can fix it yourself, right, Ben. Just get in there. It's an easy edit. Steve, great fun talking to you as always.
Absolutely, gentlemen. It's always a pleasure to talk with both of you.
And we're going to see you at any events this year?
Yes, I will be at, let me pull up the calendar. So I'm going to miss RSA, unfortunately, because it comes the week after another trip, and I do need to be back home. I will be at Cloud Connect in Santa Clara the week of March 7th. I will be at two simultaneous events in Las Vegas on the week of April 18th, Cloud Connections, as well as the Experts Conference. And then it also looks like I will be speaking at Cloud Expo and the first week in June in New York.
Awesome. Steve Riley, thanks so much for coming back.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, guys. Great to talk to you. Look forward to doing it again soon.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.